You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening. I'm Al Vohner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is author, a best-selling author, and historian Richard Frank. And he's come up with a unique a book entitled Tower of Skulls. Those people who are familiar with American history, especially World War II, and our involvement with Asia, believe that it was strictly Pearl Harbor, nothing prior to that, got us involved in World War II, at least in the Pacific arena. Richard's new book, which will actually be a trilogy over the course of three books, will be coming out over a period of time. But this first book deals with the history of the Asia-Pacific War, 1937 through 1942, and so many facts and so many things that most people didn't realize that led up to the involvement with Asia. So without further ado, as they say, Richard, nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
As I said, I mean, I think of World War II. Obviously, the European arena always comes to people's minds, our battle with Germany. That's where most people's focus. Yes, Pearl Harbor certainly was an important event and entered us into the war with Japan. But as I was reading your book, I get the sense that even before the United States got involved with any Asian nations, the Asian countries themselves, China, Japan, and so on and so forth, had their own issues, correct?
That's correct. Let me sort of frame up where I'm trying to go with the trilogy and how all this fits into exactly what you're talking about. I share the view of many people that World War II is, in effect, the greatest story in human history. It is an event that girdled the globe. It touched directly almost all the 2.3 billion people who lived at that time. Its effects have echoed down through the succeeding generations. And we have the standard narrative, like you touched upon, that, you know, for most people, World War II begins in September 39 when Hitler invades Poland, and then in December 41, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor and commences what we've come to call the Pacific War. And what I'm attempting to do in this trilogy is to install a different narrative, a narrative in which the other part of World War II, the non-European part of World War II, really commences in 1937 when full-scale hostilities begin between Japan and China. And that war is really titanic, and it involves what I call the Arc of Asia, which is in 1937, if you ran your globe and looked from India on the west, which at that point included Pakistan and Bangladesh, and went all the way to the east across China and Japan or down to the southeast to what's now Indonesia, there were about over a billion people in the world who lived in that area. And of those billion people, there were only four nation-states at that time that existed. Two had sovereignty. One was Siam, which was shortly become Thailand and Japan. Mongolia was a Soviet puppet and had no sovereignty. China had a very severely eroded sovereignty. And what I talk about in this, the whole trilogy, is really how the events from 37 to 45 not only affect what happened at that time, but also they shaped the world of the 21st century, because now in that same arc of Asia, there are at least 19 major independent nations with over half the population of the world. And you really can't understand right down to today Japan's relationships with China or Korea or the Philippines without understanding what happened in that period, which has not been forgotten in Asia.
You know, I get the sense, maybe because it's in the news on a regular basis today with the tariffs and the virus situation going on in China, that even back then, Richard, you know, China was the 900-pound elephant in the room, and no other nation was even, because of their, you know, sheer size in terms of population and even land, that nobody was going to nobody's going to grind an axe with them. But obviously, many of these smaller countries did, right?
Right. Well, actually, and in 1937, China had gone through these convulsions in the first part of the 20th century, where the dynastic rulers, which had lasted about 2,000 years, had collapsed in 1911. And then they went into a very disordered state. And they basically were subject to the predatory actions of various foreign powers or whatever here, because they were so disorganized and not unified. In 1937, Japan, thanks to occupying Manchuria in 1931, had occupied a large swath of northeast China. And then the rest of China was really this huge mosaic of regional and local power brokers. And it was not just the communists, the nationalists, as it was a typical narrative. It was a much more fractured state. So they were much more vulnerable. And also, the other thing that I learned I did not realize was that basically for about a century before that point, since 1839, no central Chinese government had been able to sustain a war against a westernized power for more than about a year. So the whole world, when fighting broke out in August of 37 in China, believed that the Japanese would very shortly thrash the Chinese and the Chinese would become supplicants to have to submit to whatever Japan dictated. And it became a much, much different situation. It was an important moment in the rise of China. And China, again, people looked at China more, as I call it, more of a prize than a participant in international politics or whatever here. They just did not have the status remotely that they have today.
I get the sense that, as you talked about, there was a lot of the Chinese dynasties were falling apart, perhaps a lot of dissension among Chinese people toward their government. Is it fair to say that Japan saw this as an opportunity for expansion and more dominance in the region?
Oh, most certainly. I mean, the Japanese, the principal geopolitical threat Japan saw was Russia and later the Soviet Union. And basically, they saw China as potentially an adjunct to their empire to provide raw materials and other things that they needed to be prepared to take on the Soviet Union. And so they saw opportunities, a glimmer in China, and were quite prepared to take advantage of them.
It's people don't realize that, it almost seems unconscionable, but the Japanese were a dominant force even back then, were they not?
Yeah, they'd westernized following the Meiji Restoration. They'd created a very very potent, very powerful and effective armed forces, both the Army and the Imperial Navy. So effectively, after World War I and what normally are called the Washington Treaties, which tried to settle up things with Japan between the U.S. and U.K., Japanese effectively have been given dominance in the Western Pacific. There was no foreign power that could really project its power effectively into the Western Pacific and match the Japanese, so they could pretty much have full reign, and they took advantage of it.
The notion that, and you point this out in your book, and again, it's startling, the fact that 45 million Chinese fled the Japanese, and you think that small nation of Japan could do this to that many people, was... Prior to that, Richard, were the Chinese and the Japanese, I mean, did they coexist side by side, peacefully?
Well, it's an interesting point. They'd actually had a war between 1894 and 1895. That was sort of the coming out party for Imperial Japan. And they trashed the Chinese, although it was more of a localized struggle in just part of the area that China occupied or was interested in. And the relationship had been at odds. And quite basically, for most of the Chinese, they really believed that the Japanese had this powerful sense of superiority and looked down on the Chinese. And in fact, after the war got started and some of the most horrendous activities the Japanese did, made the Chinese look at the thing like it was a race war. Not quite in the sense that we know from Europe and the Nazis, but nonetheless, the belief that, you know, they didn't regard the Chinese as being remotely equal people or whatever here. And in those opening months and the first 2 years of the war, the Japanese army, everywhere it went, basically had extraordinarily draconian policy that they regarded any male who was from early teens on was a potential enemy soldier and might summarily execute them, whether there was any evidence they'd ever been or were a soldier or not. And, of course, there was a massive amount of rape going on. The Japanese also, because they were not that rich a country, when they turned their army loose in China, that they didn't feed it. They expected the army to live off the land, off the Chinese. And these factors together produced these enormous tidal waves of refugees fleeing from Japanese occupation. And I use a very low number. I mean, there are numbers in academic sources that will say that there are many as 80 million or more Chinese refugees fleeing in front of the Japanese.
Yeah, that's the other aspect of the book that is just so startling, is the fact of the human toll of deaths. In the Japanese's mind, as you said, they just planted them there and said, you're going to have to sustain yourself by taking from the Chinese people, and they really, cleared the land, as they say. I mean, they took everything they could. They didn't care who got in their way. And we never see that aspect of things when we talk about World War II. But which leads me to the next question, Richard: why, after all these years, has this never become a bigger part of history?
That's a very good question, and partly I have to spool this back to the period, because one of my colleagues, Thomas Doherty at Brandeis in Boston, he's a specialist in a number of areas, but most importantly, he went through all the newsreels that Americans were seeing in the 30s and the 40s. And at that time, of course, there was no television. And the average American went to the movies twice a week, and the standard program, as they called it, always included a newsreel. And one of the things that Tom pointed out was that if you were the average American seeing the newsreels, one of the things that is sort of counterintuitive to what we would think today is that you saw a much more graphic, horrendous visual library of atrocities by the Japanese in China than anything you saw about Nazi Germany. And through World War II, I've been reading the New York Times day by day. They give almost equal attention to, or at least they give very major attention to what's going on in the Pacific and Asia. And then in the decades since that time, we've lost it. A large part of it was to the fact that when China fell to the communists, we were cut off from the sort of archival sources that were not really available. And what I've built on is what's really become available in the last two decades to restore this story in a reasonable fashion. So it sort of fell off the radar screen. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when you go to a bookstore that has a World War II section, if you count titles, Europe versus the Asia-Pacific region, it's 4-1 or better, typically.
Yeah, it's there's nothing there, and yet there's a vast history leading up. In fact, many of the events lead up to and reasons for how all the chips fell, and that's what I want to talk about further. But I do want to take a quick pause to let folks know that you're listening to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. I'm Al Voner. My guest this week is best-selling author and historian Richard Frank. His new book, Tower of Skulls, is a massive an awful lot of work there, Richard. History of the Asia-Pacific War, 1937 through 1942. And many people may think this is not essential or important. It certainly lends itself to why and how things took place during World War II. And again, because of your book, I had no idea that when all the chips kind of fell to where they would be, the Germans, because I was wondering, what the heck would Germany want to ally themselves with Japan, and why did we kind of rely on China? Well, first and foremost, as you said in your book, these two countries were at war with each other long before all of this. So it was exploiting these countries is about the best way I can put it, right? Between the United States and Germany, seeing that one could be used against the other. And is that how those relationships developed?
Well, I characterize it a little bit differently. I think the relationship with the Germans and the Japanese, they both regarded themselves as outsiders or have-nots, and that was sort of the basis for their relationship.
Uh-huh.
And it was a very ambivalent relationship. Thankfully, there was not great coordination between Germany and Japan during World War II, or it would have made the war, I think, much more difficult for the Allies. On the U.S. side, it's interesting that, to me, when the war first broke out, because the nation, U.S. at that time, public, wanted to, were not interested in intervening in any foreign wars anywhere.
Right.
And when the first fighting broke out, they did one of these popular polls and said, you know, well, how do you feel about this war? And over half the American people basically were indifferent to what was happening in China at that time. By February 1940, when they were doing polling, and they asked, who do you favor in the war between Japan and China? Japan was polling at 2%, and China was polling north of 70% among the American people. And it goes back to these images and the whole story of just how horrific the war was being depicted to the American people. And we were interested, in a way, we were a very distant trading partner with China and the Chinese compared to the British or the Japanese or whatever here. But President Roosevelt saw the war basically as a global war. And then, as he said in one passage I quote, he was asked by his ambassador in Japan, you know, what should be the guidance I should follow? And Roosevelt says the most fundamental thing to understand is that the war in Europe, in Africa, and in Asia is all part of one global struggle. And that's how FDR saw it, and that became really acute in 1941 when the two regional wars, as they probably had existed to that point, really became together into one true global war.
So there's no doubt that the U.S. government, the Roosevelt administration, the U.S. government had this on their radar screen. Did even they at that time, were they even able to consider the fact that this could turn into a global entanglement? I mean, I think if initially, as you said, most Americans were indifferent, nothing happening on our shores, life is good, why stick our nose where it doesn't right. belong? But was the U.S. government, did they monitor it closely enough, and did they do the right things, or were we too complacent?
I think by certainly the big shock for the Americans and for the administration, even though Roosevelt clearly, you know, favored anybody against Hitler from early on. But for the American people, when Nazi Germany overran Western Europe, that was the titanic shock that started the mobilization, not because we were hell-bent on going into war, but because we felt we had to be prepared against the specter that had suddenly risen in Europe or whatever here. And the supreme objective for the Roosevelt administration, which was shared, interestingly enough, in London and in Moscow, was that ideally, if the U.S. became involved in the war, they would only become involved in the war against Hitler and not have any war going on in the Far East, which would divert resources away from the confrontation with what everyone regarded as the main and most important enemy. So China figured primarily, from the American perspective, as a way to tie the Japanese down. This became really critical in the second half of 1941, after Hitler attacks the Soviet Union, and it appears for the first time in the last 10 days or so of July of 41 that the Soviet Union might actually survive, because early on everyone thought they would fall apart. Then when London and Washington are fetching around for what they can do to help, they realize there's not much they can materially do to help the Soviets in 1941, but the one supreme thing they can do is keep the Japanese from joining the war against the Soviet Union. And to do that, that means keeping the Chinese in the fight. And that's recognized on both sides, although they're careful in their public statements not to highlight that they're particularly favoring doing this to favor the Soviet Union. But it's quite clear that that's what their policy is based upon, is that there's this very telling quote from Canadian Prime Minister Mackenzie King after he meets with Roosevelt. He writes in his diary, obviously based on this, that he says, the collapse of Chinese resistance probably means the collapse of Russian resistance. So there's this clear nexus between what's happening in China and what's happening in Europe, recognized both in Washington and London in the second half of 1941.
Another aspect that I think is just touched upon in most history books is the fact that prior to World War II, especially in Asia, there was this colonial rule. British and other monarchies basically had a strong foothold in those nations. All of this turned that apple cart upside down, did it not?
Right. Well, it's a complex picture, but I think basically, clearly where things are in July 1937, it's a very much colonially dominated region. Now you can see that there were measures being taken that were pointing towards India, for instance, becoming independent, but some very distant, indistinct, you know, skyline, you know, way off in the future. The only peoples that had any clear prospect of immediate independence were the Filipinos. We promised them independence in 1944. We'd have them establish a Commonwealth government, so they were doing their own internal affairs. But everyone else that was in a colonial state was typically very distant from any freedom, and China was in total disarray. So that's one of the things, one of the themes this trilogy is going to get into, is what the complex story is in terms of how the effects of the war play out in creating the world we have today. And that's why in the third volume, a very big part of it is not, I don't simply stop in September 45 with the Japanese surrender. I go on to the post-war period to show how all this plays out.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, after reading, you know, the first installment and then hearing you this evening, long after the war, it's been many, many years, we always seem to have a hard time. We deal with them economically. I'm talking about China and even Japan,
right,
and many Asian nations.
Right.
But do you get the sense that much of the entanglement, much of the differences that we deal with today with those nations goes back or reflects back on what took place during World War II?
Well, I mean, in the larger sense, it set up the whole array of nation states and their relationships, so we can't escape from that. So it's very much with us today. And we have a very complex problem in dealing with China. The nation states like China, like Japan and Korea and Vietnam and the Philippines, all have this extraordinarily difficult history with the Japanese. So getting the Japanese into an alliance with these other nations to face the Chinese is an enormous challenge that we face now, and no doubt about it. And the other thing is that, you know, in China, the war with Japan is still a huge living memory.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been told repeatedly, a huge swath of Chinese television, when they have dramas, whatever, a huge swath of them are about the war with Japan from 1937, 1945.
So here we are 70-plus years later, and even though, you know, they're not at war with one another, the memories, the pain, I guess, the wounds are still open there.
Right.
And you'd almost get the sense that, you know, Asian nations would stick side by side because they were always thought of as much different than Europe or North America, but among each other. So, which leads me to the last question, because we're running out of time. But let me ask you, had China and Japan not been at odds, or had one or the other not participated in any way, shape, or form, would World War II have probably worked out differently? Would things have been much different?
Yeah, I think although from most perspectives, I think the Allied side, or the what we'd like to think of as the good guys, would have won. I think it would have been a much more protracted struggle because we would have, I think we would have had a greater difficulty. I really think it's difficult to say that the Japanese were going to be out of the picture after 1940 or 41. They were opportunistic, and they saw, because of the German triumphs, all these opportunities in Asia, because Germany had knocked out all these colonial powers. It's almost unbelievable the Japanese wouldn't take advantage of that.
Yeah, I'm just what you said. I'm just thinking that, you know, had they not felt that way, had they not, you know, bothered to enter the war and just, you know, let things go, then we would have just fought a European on the European,
right,
front. And I'm not minimalizing, you know, the horror that took place there. I'm just thinking it wouldn't have been,
right,
two theaters,
right,
and would we have maybe saved some lives? As they say, you can't rewrite history, right?
Right. Well, I think our losses probably would have been less, but that doesn't mean that the net for all the other nations involved would,
yeah,
necessarily have been less, particularly the Soviets.
Yeah, and certainly things that have played out today certainly would have been a whole lot different as well. So, but this the amazing thing about the book is that, as I said, you touch upon and you shed light on an aspect that is so crucial to the development of World War II, the players within World War II, how we got involved and, you know, who we allied with and who we didn't, who we were at war with and who we weren't. You know, so much of it that goes, you know, as they say, you know, by the side. Nobody even sheds light on this. And you know, which leads me to the last question: why, Richard? Why, after all these years, has this not become a more prime piece of World War II history?
That's almost exactly what struck me when I got into this. Is it's like I'm looking at this and saying, you know, why hasn't this been a fully part of the standard narrative about what went on? This is just a huge, huge part of World War II, and that's what I'm trying to address and redress or whatever here. It's perplexing as to why it's sort of totally drifted off the radar screen, but I think a large part of it does go back to the lack of access to records for historians wanted to work with, and they basically, particularly in the PRC, we were shut out of any accurate archival information for many decades after World War II.
Right.
So it just wasn't possible to work in the area the way it is now.
Yeah. I just think it's important, even if you're not a history buff per se, just to know that long before the United States got involved, either with the Europe or Asia, these nations were at war with one another and kind of set the tone for what happened, you know, long after, and what we read in history books, and I want folks to know that what we read in history books today is only still just a small part of a much larger, and you brought that to light, a much larger picture of what encompassed World War II and who exactly were involved and why. I guess those are the main reasons why all of this took place. Richard, the book, I assume, is widely available.
It will be very shortly. In a day or so, it's going to be officially in publication, but it's already out.
And you'll be up in the New England area soon?
I'm going to be up in the New York area immediately, and hopefully up in the New England area sometime in the next few months.
Great. So if people get an opportunity. So if they want to reach out, get more information about your speaking engagements, about your work and research on this trilogy, how might they do that?
My publisher, W.W. Norton, keeps a list of the appearances I'll be making.
Great. Again, the book is Tower of Skulls, the first of three installments. This one, The History of Asia-Pacific War, July 1937 through May of 1942. Crucial information, fascinating information that what led up to World War II and how the participants and who allied with who. My guest has been the author, noted historian and author, Richard Frank. If you have any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. Certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.